Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Today on The Grave Talks, part 2 of our conversation with author Tommy Netzband about his book, Haunted Hate, Ghosts and True Crime Tales from Haight Ashbury and Beyond. In San Francisco, and I didn't know this until right at the beginning of the book, has a very interesting history with cemeteries.
And yeah, we hated them.
Yeah, which is, and that's where the book starts. And I'm like, what? Because, and you're from Chicago, and I was just there and I did a ghost tour, and we were at Lincoln Park talking about all the bodies that are still probably there. And it made me think in San Francisco, probably the same thing, because they were moving cemeteries. And not within the
Native American, a lot of Native American bones that are found over by the old mission, you know, which, because you have to realize that when the Mission Dolores was founded back in the 1700s by the Spanish missionaries, that church, it still stands here in San Francisco. It's the oldest building. It predates like to colonial times. And some of the forefathers of California are buried in a little tiny cemetery that's owned by the Catholic Church. It's like the size of a backyard. Okay. And, you know, it being such a old cemetery, the folks that built it were the Native Americans that lived here. They built the church, but they were not allowed to be buried in the cemetery because if they did not convert to Catholicism, they would be buried outside the cemetery. So the whole Mission District area is filled with Native American bones. In fact, like when utility companies come out there, they're like, oh God, we're going to discover bones. We just know it. San Francisco truly hates the dead. I'm telling you, they never liked the dead here. They always complained about them from day one. And I wanted to start the book off just sort of explaining, why is this place so darn haunted? You know, well, let's look at the disrespect of the dead. They did, they removed them. They would say, oh, we're going to move this cemetery and we're going to move them here. We have people that have moved 4 or 5 times that were forefathers of, you know, this city, because they would just constantly remove. And then they created a hysteria in the early 1900s, telling people that the bodies were unhealthy. And they would have doctors testify, oh, if you breathe in the fumes of the dead, it's bad for your health. And developers and the city politicians convinced the people that these bodies were unhealthy, unsanitary. And my favorite is they called them a public nuisance.
People's loved ones.
Yep. And then it became law here in 1900 that nobody could be buried here. And all of them would have to be removed. Okay. And it took decades to remove these bodies.
And did they remove them all?
No, that is the thing. They did not remove them all. In fact, in 1992, a museum at Land's End, which has beautiful views of the bay. I mean, the dead had the best views. And they couldn't see them, but the city wanted that space. So they took this potter's field called City Cemetery and built a museum on top of it. And then in 1992, they were doing some retrofitting on the museum and they discovered over 300 bodies underneath it. They predict there's probably 10,000 bodies under the museum. You know, so San Francisco said they removed the dead, but they never did. Is very poltergeist.
Very. You know, at least Chicago had an excuse. Well, the fire came through and we don't know where anybody was buried. That's a pretty good excuse. But this almost sounds like it was prime real estate.
And it was prime real estate.
We need to get rid of these cemeteries because we can make a lot of money by building on that property.
Yes, and it's one of the reasons why San Francisco is so smushed together. You see these houses, there's no like you know, well, in Chicago, we call them gangways, these sort of spaces between the, you know, because of the mobsters, they call them gangways, you know, the sort of space between the houses that you would go to the back of the yard or something. And you don't see that a lot in San Francisco. And people say, well, why is that? Greed. Because mm-hmm. if I was a building developer and I had a block of land, I'm going to build as many houses on that land and make the most money that I can. And that is how things worked here. So this city has always been a city of money, 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 ever since the gold rush.
One thing I found real interesting about this book is that because when I think Haight-Ashbury, I go back to the Summer of Love, like we were talking about. But I assumed that these stories that you share in the book would be more early 1900s, you know, old stories. What was interesting to me is that some of these hauntings you actually trace back to the 60s.
Yes.
Which I was not expecting that. And there was one I found, there was a couple that are tragic stories. I mean, there's stories of murder, but there was one of a kid named Joey who told you he thought his, because you're known as the ghost man in the area, I think is what it said. So people know you. So
the ghost guy.
Yeah. So like, it's like me, people know that I do ghost podcasts. So I'm frequently having people tell me, you know, I don't really believe in ghosts, but this one time, and then they'll tell me this paranormal story. I'm like, why don't you believe in ghosts? What the hell was that?
Yeah.
But this kid, Joey, told you about a haunting in his building.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's interesting because I am a chatty guy. I can talk for hours, you know, and I love people. I've always loved people, and of all walks of life, you know, it doesn't matter. I feel like all of us have a common ground, you know, even if our politics don't match or whatever our beliefs, there is a common ground with everybody.
Right. I always say, we might not agree politically. We might be very different, but we can agree we like dogs. We can agree we like cats. You know, there's some place in the middle that you can both agree.
Yeah. And I tend to like my friends for the things that I like about them, not the things I dislike. And there was a guy, he was a young kid, and he worked on Haight Street, you know, one of the little shops. And I met him, and, you know, he was your typical straight, like, Haight Street kind of kid that had, like, you know, green hair and piercings and all that. And I said hi, and he goes, you know, I'm Tommy. I do the haunted Haight. Oh, you're the ghost guy. So yeah, I'm the ghost guy. And he tells me, oh, I think my place is haunted. I swear my place is haunted. And I was like, well, tell me where you live. And he says, oh, I live at 635 Ashbury. And I'm like, wait a minute. That's a very famous person's home. And it used to be the home of Janis Joplin. In 1967, she lived there with her lover, Peggy. And he goes, who's Janis Joplin? He had no idea who she was. Young kid, okay? And I was just like, well, tell me your darn ghost story anyway, right? And I just sort of took it with a grain of salt. And he starts telling me this tale about when his friends are playing PlayStation in the back of the apartment on the first floor, that they would hear somebody running, like they were running in the front room or like right outside the window, and they'd rush out and then no one would be there, okay? And I was like, oh, okay. So I started doing my research like I always do about the house and about the building. And I came across this article, which I do publish in the book. And basically I tell them, the article talks about a young kid. He was like 17 years old. And him and his three friends were walking down Ashbury Street. And a gentleman across the street yells at them and says, hey, stop. And the four kids start running. Okay. And then what happens? The guy across the street starts shooting at them. And he hits one of the kids in the head. And the kid falls to the ground, whole sidewalk just saturated with his blood. And I come back to the kid and I'm like, look, I think I found your ghost story. Okay. And he's like, was it a ghost? And I'm like, well, let me just tell you the story. Okay. So I believe I found the history of this ghost, that this last moments of this kid's life where they're running So that's what he was hearing. And I've done many, many tours. I've done over 17,000 tours, Carol.
Oh my gosh.
You know, yes, in the past 19 years. And I've had so many people on these tours. And people always tend to experience something in front of this place, you know, and I let you do some ghost hunting in front of the place as well. And Larry Watts, which was the kid's name, he's very, very active. He likes to interact with people and talk to them through the devices. And I think that, you know, ghost stories that are newer are really, really important to me too, because I think ghost stories that are 100 years old are great, but I really like to uncover new ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I'm about. I would like to do original new ghost stories.
Was that a location that was on your tour before you met Joey?
Well here's the funny thing. You know, people knew me in the neighborhood as a ghost guy, and before I even was in a tour, because I was such a nosy neighbor, you know, they always knew me as, hey, that's the guy that's looking for ghosts, you know, stories. And that's the guy who's always talking about ghosts, you know, I mean, just from knowing people in my neighborhood. And then once I got his story and found the history, because I was going to put Janis Joplin on the tour anyway, because it's Janis Joplin's right. home.
And you're walking Never past it.
Yeah, you want to see it. You know, people loved her. And it just turned out that there was a ghost in the building, but not Janis Joplin.
But I think that's so interesting that you did the research and you found this story, which would support what he's been hearing.
Yeah, I'm all about receipts and evidence. And I feel history is the best way to prove a ghost. I love the equipment. I use all that stuff, EVPs, all that great stuff. But what proves a ghost better than history?
Mm-hmm.
Really? And I'm really, I think I talk about that even in the book, that, hey, the best ghost tool is history. You know, I mean, I really only look for three types of evidence: audio, video, historical. That is all I present to people. You know, I mean, if you go into our San Francisco Ghost Society website and we show our evidence, it's usually audio, video, or historical. Yeah, because that's really the trifecta of a good ghost story. If you have audio, video, and the history, that's right. Pretty amazing.
Now, on some of these stories, like there was a story in here that I thought was real interesting. The chapter was The Ghost of Cole Street. And yes. There was a woman who thought there was a young girl there. Other people were seeing like a shadow person, a shadow man. And you did some research on that. Is that like a location? Did they come to you as you're the ghost guy and they told you this? Or was it, you know, something that you wanted to investigate on your own? Kind of a combination of the things happened?
Well, they actually, Carol, they came to me. I had talked to people in the neighborhood and I even flyered the neighborhood asking people, do you have ghost stories? I'm interested in hearing them.
And that's a great idea.
Yep. I would put like a little sign that said, got ghosts? Call me. I want to hear your story. And some would call me and give me crazy, ridiculous stories that were just outrageous, you know,
right.
Raining babies and all this, you know, so they were on LSD or something. It is the hate. And, you know, but there were a few that were interesting. Some I disproved right away. It was like, oh, no. You know, you have an old avocado green refrigerator and it's spewing in on meth fields on you guys. That's why you're paranoid. You know, I like to debunk things a lot, because if you go in this line of work and think everything's a ghost, everything becomes a ghost. So you have to be very skeptical. And I really like to keep a level head. And when the woman contacted me, she had said, hey, I got your flyer and, you know, I'm really interested. I think I have a little girl ghost. And I, why do you think it's a little girl? I just have a feeling. Okay, well, that's valid. I understand that. And I heard the story. I visited them. I investigated the place. Had some really great EMF spikes in certain areas, some interactions, and then started doing the research. I, like the woman, became obsessed with this little girl because I would tell the story on the tour and people were just, you know, what is it about ghost children that freak people out? You know, I mean, I definitely am a little freaked out by ghost children because you don't expect children to die.
Right.
You know, but I tried and tried. And once again, if a little girl had died in that area, because what you have to understand is that, and I don't even know if I really talked much about it in the book, but the area where the house is used to be an amusement park called the Chutes. Okay. So my thought was maybe this little girl died on a carnival ride or something before they built these houses. So I pored over the papers and tried to find this little girl, and it still was a mystery. And I just couldn't find her. So I kind of put it aside. I took it off the tour. I said, you know what? It's a great story, but I just don't really have any history at all. And so I took it off and just let it rest for a year or two. And then when I started writing this book, I thought, you know what, I'm going to revisit this story. I'm going to, so I started pouring through my notes and things that I had. And I said, you know, all these people are talking about this dark shadow man, you know, that's interesting. So I started just looking up like suicides, and there I saw it. It was a suicide in the apartment, and it was not a little girl. It was a young man. Okay. And there was his story. And then I would find other stories about him, and I pieced his whole story together. And I knew he wanted his story told. August Veen was his name. I knew he wanted his story told. And he really, unfortunately, killed himself over, well, what we would consider little debt. But back then, in the 1900s, early 1900s, it would have been a significant amount. Right. It was $160, okay, that he killed himself over, because he was a socialite. In fact, I pieced his whole little life together through a lot of newspaper articles. He appeared in many like socialite events, him and his sister. In fact, his father's wife was pretty prominent, okay? And he started to kind of, you know, like most young people, get a little wild. And he started to get in trouble. And he went up to Sacramento, got in some trouble in the red light district. And then he had a chauffeur that he was using, and he owed the chauffeur $160. And the chauffeur was like, I'm going to have you arrested for debt. You know, back then they'd arrest you for that stuff, you know. And he basically got into a deep depression, and you know, according to the article, his sister was cooking dinner, and he just said he was feeling blue, and he went into the back in his bedroom and he shot himself in the head and killed himself. Mm. And a lot of the activities in the back room, which used to be filled with all these dolls that she had, because see, she was a doll collector. That's why I believe she wanted it to be a little girl, but it never was a little girl. It was August Veen. He's the dark shadow man that haunts that apartment.
See, that's what I find so fascinating, that you're able to take the story of a haunting and look back and go, look, here is what happened in this building. I think that, to me, it's just kind of changes everything once you get that information.
I think that it really helps you validate the tale.
Right.
You know, history is a great way to validate a tale, to say, oh, these people who know nothing about this place are seeing this dark shadow man. And then you find out, oh my God, somebody killed themselves in the back room. It just fits. It's like putting pieces of a puzzle together. And that is really where my love and passion for ghost, you know, hunting comes. It comes in. I'm the guy that is a ghost historian. You tell me a ghost story, I want to find its history. That's so important to me. And, you know, I think that, you know, being able to put it in this book, it's been a great accomplishment too, because now all these spirits, their stories have been told.
Right.
You know, even if I sell 100 copies, 100 people know these people's story. You know, even though the book's doing a lot better than that.
Good. Do you have one story that you particularly really... it felt very fulfilling to research it and find out what the answer was? Or was it August?
Well, you know, it actually wasn't August. And it's funny because of all the stories in this book, the one that I absolutely loved the most and had a just pure delight in writing because it was such a rare opportunity is The Ghost of Zam Zam's Bar. And I don't know if you read that chapter yet, but Ghost of Zam Zam's Bar, it's a bar in Haight. And I knew the owner who haunts the bar. And never in my life of all this research have I ever known a ghost when they were alive. And, you know, just in that, it makes my makes it my favorite story because Bruno Moshe, he was the gentleman that owned the bar. And the bar opened in 1941. His father owned it. It was called Ub Zam Zam's Persian Oasis. And the whole interior of the bar is in a sort of Moorish style. And there's a beautiful hand-painted mural on the wall. And it tells like an ancient tale of these a Persian lover and Armenian guy who marries this Persian woman. And he was known throughout San Francisco as the Martini Nazi. Okay. He was one of those famous characters. You know, I don't know if you're a Seinfeld fan, if you ever know of the soup Nazi. Yeah. Well, Bruno was the Martini Nazi, and he had a lot of rules. And I discovered the bar because when I first moved to San Francisco, I had a friend of a friend who lived around the corner from the bar. I talk about her in the book. Her name was Margie, and she took me in. She didn't even know me. And she took me in and said, hey, stay with me until you get on your feet if you want to move here to San Francisco. And it was such an opportunity for me. And I took it. And I came out here and she helped me out. And she always wanted to go to this bar. Oh, it's the best martini in the world. Let's go to this bar. And I was like, well, can't you just go yourself? She's like, no, I want you to come with me. So I'd say, okay, I'd go with her. And then I'd have the martinis. And yes, they were the best in the world. But Bruno was quite the curmudgeon old man by that time in the 1990s. He had owned the bar after his father died since 1960. And he had a lot of rules. And one of the rules was you had to be seated to drink. Your money had to be on the bar. And you had better know what you want to drink or he would kick you out. If you were a hippie and had long hair, he'd be kicked out. He never allowed women in the bar alone. That is why my friend Margie made me go with her.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yes, he was very old-fashioned, quite misogynistic. And if a woman walked in the bar alone, he'd kick her out. And then if a woman came in with a man, they'd sit down at the bar. He'd give the woman a napkin, but the man didn't get a napkin. Okay. If you said, give me another dry martini, Bruno, he'd say, get the hell out of my bar and he'd kick you out. Okay. He had really unusual hours. He was open from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, Friday, Saturday. And 8 o'clock, all the tables were closed. You could only sit at the bar. If you walked in and said, well, I'll just stand, he'd say, no, you won't. Get out of my bar. He'd kick you out. And I'm taking away all the swear words he would use.
He is the martini Nazi.
He is the martini Nazi. And I knew him. He was always very nice to me, you know, because I followed his rules. You know, I felt like I was like in grade school drinking a martini, you know, like the teacher, the mean teacher. And one day after a few of his excellent martinis, he would say, I said to him, I said, hey, what's your secret? I love your martinis, they're the best. And he said, it has to be very, very cold. And he would show me, he'd pull out a big pitcher, put a bunch of ice in it. And then he would put in the gin because he only served gin martinis. If you asked for a vodka martini, he'd say, that's cobweb water in a basement. Anyway, so he told me that if you stir, 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 never shake. And then make sure that there's those ducks on the pond. Those are those little ice chips mm-hmm. you get on the top of your martini. And, you know, I took that to heart. You know, if I ever make a martini, I think about Bruno and the lots of ice and all of that. And then in 2000, he died. He died of prostate cancer. His friend took the bar over, has kept it virtually the same, except the martinis are no longer $2.50. Okay. That's what he charged, $2.50 a martini. And now I think it's like 10. But, you know, he haunts the bar. Many of the bartenders witness him haunting the bar. In fact, I've had people go in the bar. They used to put candles on the tables because now the bar is open all the time. And I have people that would tell me they would sit at the tables and start drinking their Cosmo, and then the flames of the candle would flare up. Okay. And then the bartender, one time she was making a fancy drink and all the glasses started shaking on the bar, you know, and there was no seismic activity or anything either, you know. And then another thing is the cleaning lady used to hear him arguing in the back where they used to store things. So his voice is heard. I bring people in there. I do two tours. I do a ghost hunting tour and I do a pub crawl where I take you to all the haunted bars. Okay. And both of the tours have different stories and they're just completely different tours. And I bring people in there. I bring EMF readers. We sit at the tables. I have them get their drinks and Bruno's original glasses and we chair Bruno and he reacts. In fact, the previous bar that we go to, he starts reacting in the previous bar because he can't wait for people to come into his bar. And he's very active in the bar. My favorite bar, my favorite story, because I've never, ever had a ghost that I knew them when they were alive.
And I also get why he would still be there. It was his passion. And I'm just guessing Cosmopolitans and him probably aren't a good mix. That's not a martini. No. Don't call it a martini.
Yeah, you could really only order martinis, a beer, okay? Nothing fancy.
But not even a vodka martini.
Not even a vodka martini. He only started serving vodka martinis at the very, very end. Like when right before he died, like a couple years before, he caved in and he started to serve vodka martinis. He didn't like it, but he did it. You know, because people kept requesting them, you know. I mean, even though gin martinis are original martinis, I think vodka martinis are just more popular.
Well, they are these days. And now kind of the default is vodka, where really it was gin. And all these modern martinis really aren't martinis at all, you know. And so that has to, for somebody like him, just has to drive him crazy. But you come in and you followed the rules, and he's happy to see you.
Yes. Bruno and I always got along. I never got kicked out. I'm happy to say he never kicked me out because I respected him. I respected the bar. And even the bartenders, you know, they know how much love I have for the bar. And, you know, every Halloween I give each of the bars a gift basket. This year they all got a book in the gift basket.
Oh, they had to love that.
Yeah, I do that because, you know, there's a lot of people at Halloween. It's my busiest time and they have to deal with full tours. You know, I'm bringing in 16 people in a bar at a time and they have to serve them all drinks in 20 minutes. You know, so I really appreciate them and the hard work that they do. You know, so I try to be a nice guy and give them some fun. And I always include chocolate. Because everybody wants chocolate.
Of course, everybody does. Now, if they sign up for one of your tours, and you can go online, it's hauntedhate.com, H-A-I-G-H-T, hauntedhate.com. When they take a tour, is it always with you? Or do you have some other people who do something? So it's always you.
Yes.
I'm
the sole proprietor. I do all the tours. I don't do the tours every day. I'm going to be changing it next year. But I do... Currently, pub crawl Fridays, ghost hunt tour Saturdays, and I'm researching and opening another tour, which is going to be about the black magic, witchcraft, devil worshiping, and cult leaders of the hate called Cults and Cauldrons.
Oh, when you start that one, would you come back on? Let's do another episode about that.
Yes, I'm trying to hopefully write the book simultaneously, you know, so that we can just keep them together. But that is my next tour. I actually bring it to a real witchcraft store. And we talk about, you know, the 60s and 70s. There was a lot of magic that went on here, like Anton LaVey and devil worshiping and cult leaders and all that stuff. So I really wanted to focus this new tour on the sort of magic with a K aspect of the Haight-Ashbury.
And that wraps up our conversation about haunted Haight, ghosts, and true crime tales from Haight-Ashbury and beyond with author Tommy Netzband. You can get the book through Amazon or get more information about the book and the Haunted Haight Ghost Hunting Tour and Haunted Haight Pub Crawl at their website, hauntedhaight.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. You can also find everything there. It's also all ad free. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.